Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mary Carr, whose latest book is a memoir titled Lit. Earlier books, memoirs, are Cherry and The Liars Club. Mary Carr is a professor of literature at Syracuse University and a well-known poet, and has written some controversial essays on poetry, which we will discuss a little bit later. This latest memoir, Mary Carr, concerns your life as an adult, as opposed to the other two, and it concerns the process you went through from being an alcoholic to cleaning up your act.
You know, I try to distinguish my books. I hope my books are distinct from what I call those soundbite memoirs, you know, those memoirs you can paraphrase in a sentence, I was a teenage sex slave memoir. So it is about all the ways I got lit. Part of that is literature and becoming a poet, and part of that is Jack Daniels, and part of that is baby Jesus, even. Who knew I'd become Catholic? I'm very unlikely Catholic. But I do try to create a whole world in which these things figure.
When you're talking about that, and you're talking about filling in the gaps as a novel would fill them in and making a complete whole out of it, the question arises, how do you fill in the gaps when your memory doesn't fill in all the gaps? How do you make a memoir read like a novel?
Well, obviously, at this time in literary history, the reader feels comfortable with a memoirist using novelistic devices, such as recreating dialogue or leaving out chunks of time because they weren't that damned interesting. If you read Mary McCarthy's Memories of a Catholic Girlhood in the late 40s, there's still a line for objective truth. You know, historians were still thought of as authorities, and presidents and priests weren't known as sodomites. You know, so, I mean, it was a very different time in our history as a country. It was pre-Nixon. It's when we still had heroes and some sense of objective truth. So, obviously, I don't remember everything. I've only been able to deceive myself that I do. You know, I do send the manuscript to be vetted by the main characters in it, but that's not obviously the same as living with a video camera strapped to my chest.
But the borderline between fiction and nonfiction can be hazy, can it?
I don't think so.
Really?
I really don't. I can honestly say that it's not. This is not sexing a chicken. This is not hard. I mean, if you brought in your third cousin who has a vaguely southern accent and said it was Mary Carr and interviewed her, that would not be true. You would not have interviewed Mary Carr. So I think if you're making up events, if you're fabricating events, that's fiction. Describing a scene or recreating dialogue is a very different thing than fabricating events. I threw out more than 1,000 pages of this book, finished pages, when I was 4 years late and I had a lot of pressure. They give you money for these things. They're very interested in when you deliver the manuscript. Because I felt it wasn't true, and it's not that the events changed so much. It's the cant on them is different. There's a great story I like to tell about Herman Melville where, you know, he had apparently locked himself in his study at Christmas with a bushel of oranges, and his kids were crying, and they wanted the oranges, and he wouldn't let them have them. And when my friend Jeffrey Wolfe, also a great memoirist, I think, was doing a biography of Melville, I mentioned him. Well, you know, Melville was really kind of a jerk, right? I mean, that story about the oranges, how could he not be seen as a jerk? And Jeffrey said, well, he had scurvy. So it's the inner life, it's the interpretation of events which is most important, and that's where you can lie, I mean, or deceive yourself. When I rewrite, it's not that I come up with new events to represent my theory. It's often that I have the same events, but I'm really trying to cast them differently.
You change, too. The person writing the book is not the person who's lived the life.
Obviously. I mean, we remember through a filter of self. I'm not the person who wrote The Liars Club, but I'm closer to that person than I was my seven-year self, say, so.
Well, The Liars Club, which is about your early years, was written during the period when you were going through the worst elements of your post-alcoholism.
I would say not the worst period, because I had been sober for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and I was single. I was really broke, but I wouldn't say psychically. It was, you know, I was pretty much done with therapy. I would say psychically, it wasn't such a dark time. I'd gone from being, you know, Franz Kafka. I'm still no Richard Simmons. You know, I'm not really known as the cheeriest person on the block. What poet is? But I was definitely recovered, I think, from a, you know, lifelong depression.
Well, at that point, you sat down, and as you describe in Lit, the book just seemed to write itself. Maybe not so. I mean, it may have been very painful for you to do it, but you were able to just scribble out the pages.
I believe with all these narratives, I believe we remember ourselves and invent ourselves through storytelling. So I think in all of these books, to some extent, I had an idea about the narrative, but when you read the proposal I did for the Liars Club, it actually covers most of the material of all three books. Me up through the time I got sober. It didn't include my conversion because I hadn't converted yet. That was after the book. But, you know, you have a sense of what stories you need to tell, what stories made you who you are. And when you fall in love or you make a new friend or you get to know somebody, these are the narratives that accompany that.
Going back to the Liars Club, Mary Carr, you had your outline. At what point in the process did you realize that this is just going to be a particular story rather than the life itself?
Really, I didn't know until, you know, there's a point where the book leaps forward 13 years, and my editor at the time, I was an unknown quantity. They liked what I was doing. They actually didn't edit it very much. But she kept saying, you know, how are you going to get forward 13 years? How are you going to get forward 13 years? Because I didn't want to drag people kicking and screaming through every day of my life to finish a certain narrative. And I kept saying, I don't know. I'll figure it out when I get there. I really write my way into things and out of them. When I got to the point where I just said 13 years later, and I realized I wasn't going to cover my entire adolescence, my drug-sodden adolescence, which I cover in Cherry. So I think at that point I realized I really just wanted to finish the book and have it close with that revelation with my mother. So it changed my life.
Well, it also turns it into a story.
Right.
You know, and that's what a story is about, beginning, middle, and end.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yeah, these can be very wiggly things to come up with. I never know what's in them. I initially thought this book was initially called Tropic of Squalor. And I initially thought it was going to be a book about sort of romances and love interest. And it was just insane. It was crazy. It was so much about the ways my mother was a shadow stitched to my feet.
The entire thrust of Lit, it feels as if that it is focused on you, your view toward alcohol, and then your view toward recovery, and then afterward the conversion.
And how to become a parent. I mean, I was given this, you know, little radiant slab of baby boy, and I couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't stop drinking. I've done so many sit-ups in my life. I've run so many miles, and the idea that I couldn't stop drinking was very startling to me. I felt myself morphing into that mother in the way that I found so horrifying, like turning into a vampire.
As this is going on, is a part of you going, my God, I'm becoming my mother, the
Absolutely.
One person I don't want to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I remember, and the book opens with a prologue to my son, who's now 23. You know, one of the horrifying things to me, it's a very small thing. It's not high drama, but it's not whoever has the biggest ass-whipping, you know, writes the best memoir. If that were true, then every Auschwitz survivor would have a million bestseller, or Rwanda Holocaust survivor, genocide survivor. But in order for me to get up when my son had the croup, I had to put a big glass of Jack Daniels on my nightstand. I drank myself to sleep. And when I got up, I had to have that whiskey there to get up to, or I don't know that I would have gotten up for him. And it's a small thing. I mean, it's probably something that didn't affect my son's life. You know, he was illiterate. He didn't even know he'd speak English yet. You know, I got up in the morning. But obviously, that dependence, when I look back on it, is horrifying to me.
Well, I would also think that today, if he were to think about the smells of youth, the smell of booze must be there.
So funny. I mean, he doesn't ever remember seeing me drunk. He certainly remembers me in the mental Marriott. He remembers coming to see me the 3 weeks after my suicidal gesture. I can't even call it an. You can't really call it an attempt unless you actually do something to yourself. So, I'm a sissy, despite everybody telling me how brave I am all the time. I'm a coward. But he certainly remembers that, and he certainly remembers the divorce. There's nothing really in these books he doesn't know.
The book Lit. I noticed as it's going on. I know Tobias Wolff. I've interviewed him. He's such
a great writer. I knew him as a graduate student, and he taught where I went to school, and just a fabulous American writer, really. He's a grown-up. Great family.
He gave you some advice, which was pretty much to let yourself be a bad person in the book. And it seems like as you must have been writing the book, you kept looking at that and being constantly aware that you couldn't give yourself any excuses.
Well, you know, the weird thing, Richard, was that when I wrote this in the earlier drafts, I almost made myself too bad. Now, again, not that I made up events that didn't happen, but I didn't, you know, beat my kid with a rubber hose. I didn't, you know, I wasn't stripping the babysitter. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't horrible in many of the ways I could have been horrible. But again, it's can't, you know, you don't want to write badly about your son's father. You know, we've been divorced a long time, but we're very friendly, even though you wouldn't exactly call us friends. But he stayed in my home for 15 years, seeing our son on the weekends, and I've been very grateful to co-parent with him. But, you know, I think I made him look too angelic and myself look too dastardly. And in revising the book, the first 500 pages I threw away, I think I changed that quite a bit. And again, I just remember, I mean, I remember reading it and thinking, but I wanted to drive over him when he moved the garbage cans, which is not a nice thing to do. But again, in terms of veracity, I don't think anybody would read the book and think, oh, this is the kind of person who should be driven over when he moves the garbage cans. I think it's clear who the jerk is in the book.
If I'd been in his position, I'd have walked way sooner than he did.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, he gave me every chance. He certainly did.
You made a decision to change his name to Warren.
He asked for a pseudonym, and I chose to honor that.
David Foster Wallace, you do call Dave.
Yeah, I notified David before he died that I was working on this. I would have shown him the pages. I did show the pages to his best friend, who knew us both very well at the time I wrote about, which is not the same as David having read them. But initially, I gave David a pseudonym, and afterwards decided not to because he was dead, and anybody who gave a damn sort of would have known about this.
Your sister,
mm-hmm.
That's her real name.
Well, they had the choice. They all had the choice. I gave everybody the choice. And in fact, lots of people don't want pseudonyms, but I've given them to them anyway because if you know one person, you know a lot of others, you know. If you have one name, you can trace the whole line of them. And I've just tried to give people the option not to, you know, have their privacy invaded.
I didn't realize it was David Foster Wallace until after I'd read the book.
Good. I don't think it matters that it's David Foster. I mean, people who are David Foster Wallace fans are obviously interested, and there are a lot of those. You know, for the purposes of this narrative, it's not putting in every famous person you can get your paw on. It's not putting in every event of your life because it's a prurient interest. It's trying to, I always say with these books that the antagonist has to be some aspect of your own character or else you're fighting the wrong demons. And so it has to contribute, the event or the character, other characters have to contribute to the narrative I'm writing about.
In that sense, it almost becomes novelistic in form, even if not in content.
Exactly. As soon as you decide to write one event instead of another event, you've begun to shape a narrative, and you've begun to lie. I mean, that's why the book begins, Any Way I Tell This Story is a Lie, because as soon as you choose to write about X instead of Y.
But the other thing about novels, and I've gone through this with many writers, is that in a sense they all become mysteries. There's got to be something in the narrative that is not revealed until toward the end in order to keep someone reading. Otherwise, it's, you know, what happened today and what happened tomorrow.
See, I don't think so.
Really?
I think with a novel that is true. I think with memoir, which is a cheaper form, it's not as highly wrought a form. It's not as, you don't have to be as smart to do it. You don't have to know as much. It's what Jeffrey Wolfe once called an outsider's art. I think with memoir, it's really about voice. And obviously in great novels like, say, Catcher in the Rye or To Kill a Mockingbird, or, you know, you have these amazing voices. But most novels, I think it is, you know, are plot-driven in that sense of wanting to find out what happens is what keeps someone reading forward. But I think with a memoir, the key is voice. Voice is character.
And let me ask you about all three books, putting that in perspective. How do you compare the voice that you're using in all three books to the real Mary Carr? Is it one and the same?
No, I mean, they're all constructs. It's a device. The book is a device. Philip Larkin has a great line about poetry. He says that a poem is rather like a slot machine. You know, the reader puts the penny of his attention into it, pulls a handle, and gets out a feeling. So I want to create a world, a whole world, not just a soundbite, you know, I was a drunk, I got sober. It's such a small portion of the book. But I want to create a whole world in which people connect with their own feelings and their own histories. Maybe the device for doing that is through mine, but that it should spark some living feeling in people in their own experiences. Each book is a little machine that's meant to make you feel, have powerful feelings.
You're listening to an interview with Mary Carr, whose latest memoir is titled Lit. One thing I noticed about memoirs written by poets and novels written by poets, and particularly yours, a memoir I read by Mark Doty, mm-hmm. and the recent novel I read by Nicholson Baker, mm-hmm. is there's something different about them. They're not quite the same as most prose writers, and I'm not sure what that difference is.
Wow, I hope it's that we're better. I mean, that's the lie you tell yourself. I always love the line of James Joyce, I'm sure most poets do, of, you know, everybody starts out being a poet and then they give it up because it's too hard. Hopefully it's because we do so much of the lapidary work, of that kind of watchmaker's jewel maker kind of work. Hopefully we're more attentive maybe at an individual line-by-line, sentence-by-sentence level. And often, I guess, again, that's what I'm saying about novels. You know, novelists or storytellers, even short story writers, any kind of fiction writer has to really know something about plot and story that I think the average poet or a memoirist does not know.
Well, I noticed that in reading Lit and in reading Doty's book and Baker's books, there's an attention to word detail that other writers claim they have, but I never quite see it.
Right. Yeah, I know. Well, if you look at Tobias Wolff, say, as a fiction writer or a memoirist, you know, memoirs of, you know, tremendous poetic surface, or Nabokov, you know, I teach Speak Memory. Or I just read Hilary Mantel, you know, who won the Booker with Wolf Hall this year. She has a great memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. It's one of the best memoirs I've read in a long time, partly because her voice, the surface of it, is so both plain-spoken and very bejeweled at the same time. I don't know how she does it. It's beautiful.
Had you thought anywhere along the line that you could take this material, let's say after you'd written Liar's Club, and put it in novelistic form?
You know, I think it's a psychological choice, whether you become a novelist or a nonfiction writer. I remember pointing out to DeLillo once that there's a scene in Underworld that he actually told me had happened with his aunt praying the rosary in the basement of his house in the Bronx and having a vision of St. Anthony. And I said, would you ever write memoir or nonfiction? He actually kind of winced, sort of like I'd thrown something nasty on him. And I think that a real fiction writer tells the truth better in fiction, you know. And a real memoirist, you know, when I tried to write Liar's Club as a novel, well, first off, I just didn't know enough about novels. I was in my early 30s. But I really used the novel form as an excuse to correct history in a way that I never would in nonfiction, because you're going to see the people are in the book. And if you just make stuff up. So, I mean, when people say there's a thin line, you know, that's James Frey on Larry King, you know, sort of dancing, his tap dancing as fast as he can while a million little dollars fly out the window.
But there's also, you know, there's also in Cold Blood and Armies of the Night, which in their own way kind of move in that direction. I thought Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test was there,
right,
too, but according to Robert Stone, who was there, Wolf was a reporter, not a novelist.
Right. Well, yeah, or if you read Michael Hare's Dispatches, which has that very psychedelic surface. Again, I think a lot of those books are obviously corrupt in their use of memory or actual reality, but they're also books that, like my books, kind of announce that corruption. And I think I really try to collude with the reader about what I don't know. I don't remember the conversation I had with my ex-husband when we decided finally to divorce. And in some ways, I felt the reader was owed that, and obviously my editors felt the reader was owed that, and I thought it was better to tell the reader that fact rather than, I mean, I just wouldn't make something up. I sometimes just say, I don't remember this.
Well, I recall in that particular section, you kind of talk about what you think might have happened and then say, I absolutely don't know. This
right.
is what I wish I had said, but who
yeah,
knows?
Who knows? Who knows? And there's some vague things that I remember, but I'm not sure they're from that specific time. And
did you ask him about it?
No, because it's not about his memory. It's not about his character.
So you're not even looking for corroboration at any particular time.
At the end of the book, I would have preferred that he vet the pages, which he didn't do. But our couples therapist did. I sent it to our couples therapist. So I did offer him the chance in advance. I said, would you rather vet the pages or have a pseudonym? And he preferred a pseudonym. And like I said, sending it to the couples counselor and people who knew us at the time is not the same as his having read it. But I don't feel obligated to represent other people's points of view, is my point of view. And I think anybody who reads the book can tell that my point of view is very, like I said, I want to hit him on the head with a mallet while I'm lying in bed with him. And I don't think people read that and then think, oh, what a jerk. You know, she wanted to hit him on the head with a mallet. I think people hear that and think she was nuts. You know, she wanted to hit him on the head with a mallet. So that's what I mean about the corruption. You know, I'm speaking through my feeling.
When I read a sentence like that, I'm thinking, you know, I had a very, very bad dog for a long time, and I wanted to take that dog and climb to the highest building and drop the dog. That doesn't mean I would ever do it,
right.
And the dog lasted to 20.
Yeah, you know? I didn't hit him on the head with a mallet, you
right.
know. But I'm sure, you know, he'd like to have drop-kicked me around the block a few times, which he never did. So, I mean, in all fairness to him, he was, as you say, he was nothing if not richly provoked. He was endlessly tolerant. And there's no way you can write about your divorce and sound like a good human unit. I'm no exception.
The last part of the book, Mary Carr, takes you through AA, which you don't call AA, into Catholicism. I would guess that for you, that might have been the hardest part of the book to write. Simply
so hard, Richard. I'm so glad you know that. It was so hard. That's the second draft. I threw away 500 pages. It was, yeah, trying to write it. It's like tap dancing on the radio, you know. I'm writing about spiritual matters to a secular audience.
It's a hard thing to do, particularly when you're talking about a very conservative church like the Catholic Church.
There's a Catholic left, just as there's a Catholic right. Although I've got to say, one of the places I found myself on this book tour in Washington, D.C., was at the offices of, or one of the central churches for Opus Dei in Washington, D.C., which is the Catholic Rite. And I was very well treated there, and you know, I spoke to their book club, and I've got to say, there's some extremely smart, well-read people with whom I disagree about almost everything. But to me, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, or the doctrine of the Catholic Church, is no more the church than, you know, George Bush was America, or the Pentagon is America. We are the body of Christ. And certainly, you know, the Catholic Church didn't elect me a spokesperson, and I probably barely got in under the wire anyway, getting baptized and confirmed. I've got to say, I do enjoy the sacraments. I go to Mass, I go to confession. I have a spiritual advisor. I've done the Ignatian prayer exercises, gosh, almost 10 years ago. I'll probably do them again in the next year. You know, strangely enough, but yeah, I would have laughed myself cockeyed if you had said I was going to be Catholic. There is a Catholic left, and there's a great tradition in the church, as there is in any church, temple, mosque, or zendo, in charity and work with the poor, and there's plenty to admire.
What do you think is the relationship between faith and ritual?
Gosh, I wish I knew. That's a better question, you know, for James, right? Variety of religious experiences.
Yeah, but I'm asking you because it seems to me in the context of this book, from where I'm sitting as an outsider looking in, I'm seeing someone who somehow didn't come to faith until somehow the ritual got under your skin.
You know, that's what a lot of artists say. That's not actually how I feel. That okay. The ritual is the least of it. I was not impressed with the majesty of the Mass. I often found it kind of tedious. I love it now, actually. I've come to love it. It's come to mean something to me. For me, it was the carnality of the church, the fact that there was a body on the cross. You know, in the Protestant religion, there's no body. It's very subtle. You know, you can imagine everything. And maybe the carnality of the Mass, even, the standing and rising and praying. And, you know, I guess to some extent, you know, my first church was poetry, the Church of Poetry, and as Robert Haas has said, it's a Eucharistic art. You take someone else's suffering, and you're changed by it.
It seemed to me in reading this that what you're saying about faith and the power of prayer, it's not so much the particular religion, but something inside, and then in a way you glom onto the religion.
I wouldn't say glom onto the religion, although I certainly it's necessary for me to glom onto. I know it looks that way to people who don't practice a religion, but people who judge a religion based on its doctrine and how it looks from the outside are like people who've watched porn and think they know about a woman's vagina. They don't. Or you read a lot of gynecology textbooks and you think, now I've really got it down. I'm a real expert on this. So really to understand, I think, any faith, including the crazy snake handling and the guys selling incense at the airport and put your hand on the TV screen and send me a dollar, folks, I think you have to practice it. And I do think that the Holy Spirit takes many forms. I think that there is a force for good. You know, my, you know, atheist friends, I think, are as informed and guided by the Holy Spirit often in their lives as, but for me, I need this stuff. I mean, if you knew me before and you knew me after, you would say that this is a big win, like for the planet and for baby Jesus going out, because this has really helped what was a pretty nasty disposition, and mainly in terms of helping me to look at my fellow human beings with a lot more light and less fear. I think I grew up in a very fearful household as a very fearful person. What I always thought protected me, you know, the sort of cynicism and rage and intellect, those things I thought were PowerPoints for me, I've realized are actually not as powerful as simple compassion or simple love. That's where the actual, you know, as Gandhi knew, that's where the actual power is. That's been a real surprise for me. Without the church, I don't think I would do that so much.
It also seems to me, at least, that in order to get to where you are now, you know, you had to go through all that, including the other side of it is that if you hadn't gone through it, we wouldn't be seeing Liars Club, Cherry and Lit either.
Right, and I wouldn't have made any money. I'd just be a poet. I'd be a sniveling little poet, you know, rocking back and forth in my room and quoting Rilke.
Mary Carr, you wrote a very controversial essay called Against Decoration, which is kind of an ode to content over style, as it's
right.
Said. It reminds me back when I was in college about the idea of form and feeling versus representational art.
It's funny. It's not meant to oppose form. It was written at sort of the height of what was then called the New Formalism, but it also applies, I think, today. There's a great quote from Wallace Stevens in the book, people should like poetry the way a child likes snow, and they would if poets wrote it. And often, I think, art forms go astray from audience need. You know, I'm thinking about the 19th century when Dickens was writing these novels of gritty urban reality. And poets are writing about fairies and knights in armor. Often, you know, the poems you see, say, in the New Yorker, which publishes me, so this isn't sour grapes, they're not about anything. They're not meant to make you feel anything. They're about a kind of hermetic experience. Or often they gesture to the intellect or of the writer. And they're not that interested in how the reader feels. And it's some tedious crap. I mean, I'm sorry. You know, I mean, I think poetry is going to survive without my saying that. But there's a lot of great poetry being written that is written to move the human heart and salve the human soul that is, you know, the kind of poetry I can't live without.
You know, talking to Nicholson Baker about this not long ago, and he was saying that once you call rap poetry, once you call song lyrics poetry, then you begin to see that those are the forms that people are listening to. And
I would call those songs. I mean, well, you know, the truth is, and Haas was the one when he was poet laureate who pointed this out, there's more poetry published, written, and read in this country than there was in the age of Wordsworth when a bestseller was 800 copies and 80% of the population was illiterate of London when the test was whether or not you could write your name. So, you know, poetry is going to do just fine. I mean, the other reason I think there's been a surge of interest in memoir is the kind of hyper-intellectual fiction that's derived from metafiction and people trying to write in this very cool, stylized, often very allegorical, satirical, hip fiction about characters we don't give a damn about. You know, I say that. I mean, DeLillo is a friend of mine, I think, a great novelist. I just listened to the Lydia Davis Reading a Story, which is a very kind of experimental fiction. And Laurie Moore, I think, is a great fiction writer. Hilary Mantel, the British novelist, I think, a great fiction. There's plenty of great fiction out there. There's also a lot of tedious, over-intellectual, self-involved horse dookie. That's as self-involved and narcissistic, I think, as any of any two-bit I was a teenage sex slave memoir, you know, that you read. Under the guise of being experimental, it feels like really bad, slick, urban, hip television. You know, or people trying to copy David Foster Wallace. And the problem is, David really was smarter than everybody else. So when people who are less smart try to copy him, you know, they're kind of strapping on a style that he very easily got up for.
What's the difference between bad poetry and good poetry?
How you feel when you read it, not how the writer feels. And I think, you know, for all the disagreement, I mean, one of the things I write about in Lit was working with mentally disabled women in Minnesota as part of a community poetry project. And I used to read them poems that sounded alike. I used to read, like, there's a scene where I read a Neruda poem called Walking Around. And it so happens I'm sick of being a man. I'm sick of my hair and my arms and my teeth and my shadow, and an imitation of that. And the women, most of whom were double-digit IQ, couldn't write their own names, had to dictate their poems. Week after week after week, I went there for years. It seemed to me, could at the highest level of quality tell the difference between a great poem and a crappy one or an okay one, even if it was a difficult kind of poet, even if it's somebody like Wallace Stevens, say, who writes a very cool kind of poetry that you would think of as obscure, obtuse, they could tell the difference in that and an Ashbery poem that was, say, imitating Stevens. I believe at the highest level of quality, we know exactly what the best poetry is. It's in the muddy middle. You know, when students say to me, how do I get published? I say, write something as great as Catcher in the Rye. You know, write something like Whitman's Song of Myself. You write something that good, believe me, it'll see the light of print. I'm always amazed when I give my graduate students, you know, a book of however many Emily Dickinson poems, and the same 15 poems are sifted through year after year after year by people who haven't read Dickinson before.
Well, can they be identified in advance? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, we all have different tastes. Something I think is great, someone else may not, and you almost have to go to the 100th person to figure out, well...
That's the weird thing, Richard. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying there really is something, that there is this thing called quality at the highest level where we all kind of agree. Again, I think there are like mediocre Wallace Stevens poems that you and I would quibble over, mediocre Whitman poems you and I would, or passages of Song of Myself we quibble over. But at the level, say, of that Neruda poem, it makes your hair stand up on the back of your neck, or the Dickinson, you know, After Great Pain, a Formal Feeling Comes. I'm not a big fan of Dickinson, or the vast majority of Dickinson, but you read that poem and you understand what all the blah blah is about, you know.
And then when you get past that, the entire poetry world and their little petty jealousies just fall away.
It just doesn't matter. That's exactly right. It's a constant struggle, I think, or especially early in one's writing life, to try to set a standard that has to do with history instead of the marketplace.
Mary Carr, you've written Lit, and you've delved into your deepest places. There's a quote in an NPR interview where you said writing the book was horrible. What do you think you've...
It's a shocking nightmare.
What do you think you've learned on the other side of it?
I'm surprised at its rapturous reviews. This is 9 years between my last memoir and this memoir. It's not 2 years. These books don't come out of me like link sausages. And I do struggle writing them. What have I learned? You know, that's a problem, Richard. Whatever you learn with one book has no application to the next. It's so sad. By the time you know how to write this book, I remember calling Robert Haas and, you know, just telling him with despair I was writing a horrible book. And he said, well, it'll be a horrible book with some really good sentences in it. You know, most books are horrible. Most books are bad. And, you know, the truth is, I try to recreate the wheel with every book, and whether I succeed or fail is up to the readers, really. I mean, they are the ones that, you know, put the penny of their attention into that slot, and if they get a feeling out, then it's a win for all of us. So.
Mary Carr, now you've written these books were pretty much caught up on the life of Mary Carr. I'm not sure how much more you can dredge, though I'm sure there's something there.
You think there's something there?
Have you thought about writing fiction now? Have you thought about...
I've never thought about writing
really?
Fiction. The few times I've tried to write fiction just as an exercise, everybody's dead by the bottom of the first page. It's just, it's comical.
So what do you do then?
Sort of, I pray. I pray about what to do. Right now I'm working on poems. And I have this idea about a book about memoir that I would like to be like Forrester's Aspects of the Novel or like John Gardner's Unmoral Fiction. I would like to write a book that is both a critical book with some how-to elements that, you know, talks about the standard that to me is not that complicated. I know a lot of memoirists in this area, Maxine Hahn Kingston, Tobias Wolff, Jeffrey Wolff, Frank Comroy I knew, John Edgar Wideman. Most of those people fight very hard to tell the truth. They really do. They're not like most journalists aren't Jason Blair just kind of making up their interviews. You know, I don't think anybody really sets out in this business to just make it all up. So I think there are standards that are understood by people who care about their readers that aren't that hard to define.
Do you feel complete in terms of telling your own story at this point?
Gosh. I just wanted to make some money, Richard. I would like to say I wrote these books to help everybody, like everybody on Oprah says, but I really didn't. These books are very hard for me to write, and if I didn't need tuition money, I probably wouldn't have written this book. That's the honest-to-God truth. Now, I love the form. I've been teaching memoir since 85, and I obviously care, have a great passion for the form, but I'm really not doing this just to tell my story.
You've been listening to an interview with Mary Carr, whose latest memoir is titled Lit. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.